him, I was a close friend of Usman Shukri, and wondered where he was. The officer informed me immediately and matter-of-factly, Usman Shukri did not return from a mission. What happened? He shrugged. A Navid failure, I believe. A Navid failure. Could he have crash-landed somewhere? I suppose so. He paused. In theory. Then seeing my face, he said, who can say? Maybe he will make his own way home one day.
Tomorrow in Brazzaville Beach, Hope, Ian and several boy soldiers are being driven to an unknown destination and they've no idea what to expect.
The UN has released emergency funding for research into maternal death syndrome, leading scientists...
When a virus starts killing pregnant women, a radical solution is proposed.
You get a live baby out of a dead mother.
They're in an induced coma.
Don't you see what's happening? It's normal now for men to hate women.
You'll be taking these girls' lives, Joe.
Dangerous visions. The testament of Jesse Lamb.
I'll set everything down that happened, so there can be no doubt in anybody's mind about what I want to do and why.
Hear The Omnibus at noon on Saturday on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, from 2009, Radiohead by John Osborne. Over the course of a year, the 26-year-old author decided to listen to a different radio station every day. His adventures on the airwaves also led him to investigate some of the pioneering history of the early days of music radio. It's read by Lee Ingleby.
Pirate radio stations have always fascinated me. I think I relate to the shambolic, the unordered, the anarchic. Some of my CDs are in the wrong cases, and I'm not exactly sure how much national insurance I'm paying.
This is John Peel, your head gardener, so to speak, in the perfume garden. Play on words. What will he do next? Here's Jeff Beck and the B-side of Tallyman, and it is called Rock My Plimsoll.
It was listening to John Peel on Radio 1 that made me aware of the existence of pirate radio. Peel described the perfumed garden show he presented in the 60s on the pirate radio station Radio London as a sacred little corner of hippiedom magically unsullied by commercial forces.
5 minutes past 12. Hello. It's nice to have you in the perfume garden tonight. And we will wander together and look at nice things through leafy bowers and stuff like this, and we find some interesting things together.
He read out listeners' poetry and played the type of music that people had never heard before. Captain Beefheart, Loudon Wainwright. Despite never having heard the show, I was captivated by it. Peel wanted his listeners to know that they were not on their own, that solitude had become something to be cherished rather than feared. Peel's show went hand in hand with the birth of Flower Power and the Summer of Love. It was a photograph of John F. Kennedy's teenage daughter, Caroline, which gave the Irish entrepreneur, Ronan O'Reilly, the desire to create a radio station inspired by the teenage girl's visage, whose youth, excitement and optimism he wanted to capture, preserve and use as an inspiration for the newly founded Radio Caroline. O'Reilly vowed to bring the 1960s Chelsea swagger to the radio sets of the UK. London was swinging like it had never swung before. Chelsea was awash with rock stars, models, raconteurs and designers, and somewhere on the North Sea waves were the ships which Radio London and Radio Caroline operated from. At the time, the pirate stations were crucial to popular culture because the BBC gave such low priority to music. Elvis Presley, Little Richard and the Beatles had ensured that music would never be the same again. But the BBC's stance was a refusal to acknowledge that there was a much cooler party just around the corner that everyone was invited to, and instead carried on playing orchestra music, perhaps frightened to unsettle its audience. Radio London was ultimately closed down by the Marine Offences Bill in 1967. But pirate radio stations had already made their mark and were crucial to the development of music on the radio. And as a result of the pirates' popularity, local stations were created, which ultimately led to the birth of Radio 1 only months later. What appealed to me most about pirate radio was the image of DJs broadcasting in force 10 gales and snowstorms. The pirates had certain songs they would play if they got in trouble, which would be coded messages to people on land, who would realise that help was needed. I liked the idea of the presenters being seasick in between records, playing the Velvet Underground by candlelight, standing on the crow's nest listening to Donovan. It seemed to me an idyllic life. All the DJs were there purely for their love of music. They were so passionate about what they were hearing, the records they bought and bands they had seen, that they were prepared to risk their lives to be at sea. Until it was granted a radio licence by the Department of Trade and Industry in 2000, KISS operated as a pirate radio station, and even though broadcasting illegally, still attracted over 500,000 listeners. KISS first aired in 1985 and broadcast to London. Its fan base and credibility were due to acid house nights it put on at London's Wag Club. The growth of urban music and rap had created a need for a radio station to play the music that was becoming popular with London teenagers. And clever marketing by KISS FM made the station credible to a completely new audience. KISS was owned by its DJs, who were all shareholders. They attracted a loyal listenership, and there was a widely held excitement about the vibrancy and hope of the new wave of UK hip-hop and garage. I switch on to KISS FM at 9 p.m, when Dynamite MC starts his show, billed as the freshest in hip-hop and R&B. I've never really listened to the music that KISS FM champions. I don't like hip-hop and R&B. I like Cumberland sausages and armchairs. I sit slouched on the settee playing computer games, still sulking slightly from earlier on this afternoon when, after my lunch break, I arrived back in the office and saw Poppy had a basket of muffins on her desk, wrapped in a bow. The afternoon was agony. Every time I looked round to her desk, she was there, smiling with blueberry lips. Mondays at work are hard enough to get through without somebody ordering muffins for Poppy. Eventually, I pull myself together and start to enjoy listening to KISS. Not so much for the music being played, but because of the infectious enthusiasm of Dynamite MC. He plays the Wu-Tang Clan and Jay-Z, but it's his gusto which makes me decide to switch off my Xbox and move out onto the tiny balcony at the back of the block of flats I live in. I turn the music up through my headphones and make myself comfortable, spreading out over the wooden floorboards. I keep a stash of drinks on my balcony, and I pour some supermarket-owned brand rum into a mug, mix it with some supermarket-owned brand cola, and start to imagine that the show is being recorded on a boat in the pitch black of the late-night North Sea, and that I am a teenager again.
KISS presents Logan Summer.
Yo, Logan! Yo, press that silver button on that dick there. Pull that up!
Hey, Logan, take this one down, 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 down.
At 11 o'clock, it's time for Logan Summer, who presents the world's only 100% grime radio show every Monday. I have no idea what grime is. The first track he plays is the new Kano single. Grime MC, text in what you think of it, Summer tells us. And 15 minutes later, he plays it again. I like the idea of playing the same song twice in the same show. If you buy a new CD, you'll listen to it more than once before you make your mind up about it.
Intrigued by the beat, touched by the words, homework, study every noun, every verb. Nerd, wait before we heard these verses. Used to be so good, so perfect. Intelligent, straight A student, move with a blazer on through the corridor. Shine of a rave before and played Commodore 64 still. From 4 till 6 on the weekend, radio's on. The video killed that radio star. Channel U, heavy rotation, sky remote control.
My only problem is how to critique grime. I text in, really good, Kano rocks, from John, sitting on his balcony in Norwich. No matter how grimy you are, deep down all you want is to be appreciated as really good, even if it is by a 25-year-old drinking rum alone at midnight. The next day, I switch on my digital radio and scan through the channels. On releasing my finger, the radio lottery decides I will spend the day listening to Classic FM. I've never liked classical music, and never will, even if I live until I'm 30. I don't know a double bass from a cello, wouldn't have a clue what to do with a cor anglais, whether to blow it, suck it, pluck it, hit it with a stick. I like Blur. But that is exactly why I should be listening to Classic FM today. It makes no sense to say you don't like something if you haven't even tried it. Listening to different radio stations every day is the perfect excuse to try out new things, to open up my imagination a little. For your unassuaged pleasure, I bring you Beethoven and Rossini back to back, says Simon Bates as my face sinks into the pillow. People text in, what a beautiful, relaxing morning. Thank you for the tranquility. We are having a lovely holiday in Tuscany. The references to relaxation are ceaseless. It seems that any sentence that does not mention serenity will cause the entire nation to flap around, their blood pressure soaring, panic-buying stress balls. It is 9:15, and the open plan office ripples with perfunctory hellos, swivel chairs being adjusted, people trying to conceal their yawns. I switch on my computer and say hello to Alan Medlicott and Craig. They are wearing matching ties. Their body clocks becoming more synchronised every day. Soon they'll be sharing sandwiches, going on day trips to places of historical significance, cutting each other's hair. Sorry for being late, I say. Alan Medlicott looks at his watch. I think about asking how he is, but just get on with my work. Let the day pass as normally as possible. Moments of calm with Brahms, Bates says, playing a lullaby, and I am able to take deep breaths again, look forward to the day ahead. I like Bates. His voice is gift-wrapped in tissue paper, scattered with rose petals, double-bowed with red ribbon. Classic FM has 6 million listeners, far more than initially predicted at the station's launch in 1992. Its popularity is largely because of the station's accessible playlist that has been carefully put together to appeal to people who work in art galleries, who go on holiday to Tuscany, who are at home during the day, baking. Their clear rivals are BBC Radio 3, which many people find too serious and unnecessarily stuffy. In turn, many of Classic FM's detractors complain that it panders to an audience that does not understand music, that if you knew anything about classical music, you would listen to Radio 3. Despite Radio 3's traditional fans who value the culture and intelligence of the station, Classic FM has three times as many listeners. Part of the commercial station's evolution has involved playing what they call popular classics, or what I call songs from adverts and films. To the classical aficionado, I'm sure this is something to be spat at, that Rachmaninoff would be spinning in his grave knowing that his legacy lives on in a Toyota advert, or in the background of a film while Orlando Bloom is snogging someone. But this is the music people like to hear. The listening figures are testament to the way Classic FM brings classical music to the masses without being pretentious. From 1 o'clock, Jamie Crick presents Classic FM requests and urges us to send in our suggestions. It's my dinner hour and I eat my sandwiches while walking round the industrial estate. As for the first time this week, it isn't raining. People text in, Mary, I'd like to hear The Merry Widow because my husband and I are learning it on our clarinets. I find it interesting that people listen to Classic FM and tolerate the constant interruption of adverts. To relieve the tedium of the day, I decide I'll request a song too and think about who the lucky recipient should be. One of my friends? Me? Alan Medlicott? I decide on a romantic gesture of my own and dedicate a song to Poppy. Hi Jamie, can you play Pachelbel for Poppy, even though she will never hear it? From John at work in Norwich. I like Pachelbel. I heard him on an advert once. Alan Medlicott gives me a stack of papers and I spend the afternoon in the filing room. Time stands still in this room. As with casinos, there is no clock, no window, no evidence of the transformation of daylight into dusk, just the light bulb swinging from a flex. As I file, I listen to the afternoon show with Mark Forrest, who starts his show with Schubert. I will forever associate classical music with this room, a stack of papers in my hands as I stoop, squint, alphabeticise. And then it happens. Can you play Pachelbel for Poppy, even though she will never hear it? From John, at his desk, in Norwich. I open the door to the filing room and look over at Poppy. She walks to the fax machine, and violins start to play.
Lee Ingleby was reading from Radiohead by John Osborne. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production from 2009.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Luke Tuddenham, and we've an hour of drama to come here on 4 Extra, narrated by no less a dramatic force than Harold Pinter. New Grub Street takes us into London's literary and journalistic circles of the 1880s, where Reardon and Milvain's personal and literary fortunes diverge. Later, there's an hour of classic comedy. Fraser turns crazy with power in Dad's Army at 7. Now for the second part of New Grub Street by George Gissing, dramatised by Tony Ramsay. Following disappointing returns from his literary endeavours, Edwin Reardon's marriage is on the verge of collapse. However, he's written a book in a new, seemingly more commercial style.
New Grub Street by George Gissing, dramatised by Tony Ramsay, with Harold Pinter as the narrator. Episode 2.
With the failure of his last novel, Edwin Reardon was only too aware that financial catastrophe was silently bearing down on him like a ship in the night. However, in the weeks that followed the book's publication, he clung to the lifeline of his daily routine at the desk. The coldness that had entered his relationship with his wife, Amy, prevented her asking what he did there, and he did not choose to tell her. On the contrary, as the new work progressed, he derived some strange pleasure from the fact she knew nothing of this last attempt to avert the disaster of their possible separation.
Am I disturbing you?
No, I won't do any more tonight. What is it?
Edwin, we must decide what we are to do.
I was under the impression you had decided already.
We cannot put this off any longer. If we do nothing, what little money we have will soon be gone.
So, we are to give up the lease, store our furniture, and while you take William to your mother's, I am to be dispatched to some seaside garret.
To write the book that will restore your reputation, yes. I promise you I do not welcome the prospect either.
It may not be necessary.
And why not?
Here. I have taken your advice, yours and Jasper's.
A new book?
I have written a sensation story in a single volume. I have ignored the demands of the novelist Edwin Reardon and considered only the demands of the market. Here is the result.
How much is it worth, do you think?
Heavens, don't ask me that.
Then how much can you expect?
I've no idea. Markland got 200. I can't believe we'll get that. But they can hardly give us less than the 75 we got for Margaret Home.
Enough to keep us here?
I believe so.
These last 3 weeks, barely a kind word has passed between us. You've hardly seen your son.
I'm sorry if I've been too busy to give you the attention I might otherwise have done, but writing under these conditions is no easy task.
No doubt you would find it easier if we were not here.
That's not what I meant. Amy!
I have to see to William.
Oh.
Miss Yule, let me help you with those.
Mr. Milvain, why? Thank you.
Now, what is it this time? Another article on classical metrics?
My father is looking at the legacy of Ovid in the 17th century.
Is he indeed? And you're doing the spade work?
I'm helping with the research, yes.
You can't spend your whole life drudging for your father, you know. Why not write something under your own name? I could help you place it.
Thank you. But I couldn't presume on your friendship like that.
Oh, but that's what friends are for. You have to make the best of them. Ask anyone in publishing today. An outsider with a good article is no match for someone you know with an average one. That's why acquiring friends is so important.
You're very kind. But my work for my father takes most of my time. I count it a privilege to be able to help a man of his reputation.
Well, your father's reputation isn't altogether to be envied, you know.
And why not?
No. His style is solid enough anyway.